and our studio manager, Drew Leckie.
Summer. Radio 2 celebrates jazz.
From the greats
to up-and-coming talent.
We're celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Cheltenham Jazz Festival.
Bringing you all the highlights. Every syncopation,
improvisation,
and chord.
Plus plenty of wonderful playlists picked by Jamie Cullum, Nitin Sawhney, and me, Yolanda Brown.
Radio 2 Celebrates Jazz.
Listen now. Search for Radio 2 Celebrates Jazz on BBC Sounds.
It's midday now and time for Private Passions, and Michael Buckley's guest is the doctor and charity founder, Waheed Arian.
Watching the terrible war in Ukraine unfold, it's been deeply moving to see the huge crowds of people queuing at the border, dragging small suitcases, carrying babies and children, leaving their homeland behind. Well, my guest today, Dr. Waheed Arian, knows what it's like to be forced to leave your home, suddenly and under fire. He's a refugee from an earlier war, the Soviet-Afghan War, which lasted for almost 10 years and claimed the lives of as many as 2 million Afghan civilians. 5 million people are estimated to have left the country as refugees, and Waheed Arian was one of them. In 1988, at the age of 5, he escaped on horseback from Afghanistan to Pakistan, arriving at a refugee camp on the northwest frontier. In the camp, he almost died from malnutrition, malaria, and TB. But, just in time, he managed to get medical treatment, and the doctor who treated him inspired an ambition to be a doctor himself and to help others like him. Dr. Waheed Arian is now an A&E doctor in the NHS, and he's founded a pioneering medical charity, Arian Teleheal. He's received many awards for his work and has written about his life in a vivid memoir, In the Wars. It's such a moving journey, Waheed, and horribly topical at the moment.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael. It's really triggering for me personally to be watching this devastating scene. So many of them coming from Ukraine. My heart goes out to all the people who are suffering on the ground and for the families who are away and they're watching the loved ones suffer. And the jets screaming above, the tanks rolling in, the bullets flying, they all just remind me personally of the Soviet an Afghan conflict in the 80s and the subsequent civil war in the 90s.
So you know that the mental damage that that's doing to young people, not to mention the physical.
Almost all of us have elements of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. It was not diagnosed when I came to the UK, and I'll touch upon later on during the story. But then later on, when we see any of these scenes of conflict, even if it's decades later, they will be triggering for us. They can come in form of nightmares, flashbacks. For me, as a physician now, I'm aware when they come in, so I know how to cope with them. And they're not at the level that disrupt my day-to-day life. When they start disrupting day-to-day life, that's when it becomes problematic.
We have some very varied music today, which takes in Schubert, Charlie Chaplin, as well as Afghan and Indian music. But let's start at the beginning of your own story and your childhood in Afghanistan. Born in 1983, the war had been raging for 3.5 years. You were living right in the centre of Kabul. So how did your parents try to hide the reality of war from you? What did they tell you, because you were so little?
This is such a complex topic because now we see so many children, some of them even walk to safety in Ukraine. And some of the children who are watching here, how do we tell them that? I remember my own time of how my mother was telling us that, oh, these are some fireworks outside because it was just nonstop every night in Kabul. Within a few years of me being born in, and we were living in a Kabul residential area called Sharanau, my father had to escape because they wanted him to serve on the military. And that usually meant that he had to fight his fellow Afghans, and he didn't want to do that. And also it meant a death sentence. So the last time I remember seeing him was him coming in his military uniform, kneeling down and giving me a big kite, and suddenly he disappeared. It's a kite that he found outside from the kite fighting. And then after that, I was asking, where is my father? And my mum would just, again, make some excuses that, oh, he's gone to work, and that would take months and months and months. But they would soothe us by giving us hugs, by telling us it's fireworks, it will be fine, just taking one night at a time.
When your dad was not away, he was quite a great storyteller, wasn't he? And I think he used to distract you by telling you the plots of Bollywood movies. And actually, that takes us to our first music rather nicely, doesn't it?
It does. He was a great storyteller. And whenever we used to go and visit him in Loga province, which is about 50 kilometres away from the capital, he used to hide there in mountains, in villages. We would go every few months. We would not know that we were going to visit our father because my mother would keep it secret. But suddenly he would reappear out of nowhere. And that would be absolutely magical. He would give us a big hug. Mm-hmm. And that night I would be looking forward to him telling us stories.
Now, there's a very famous singer who sadly died quite recently, but at a great age. Just tell us who we're going to hear.
Lata Mangeshkar. Yeah, she's a legend. She's one of the greatest singers in India and in the world. My father would listen to her songs, and I would, of course, next to my dad, I would listen. So I grew up listening to her, and there was so much soothing, there was so much calming, and there was so much peace in that music that it would instill hope in despite what was going on.
Lata Mangeshkar with Don't Break the Promise, a song from The Heart Given to You, a 1987 Bollywood film. The composer was Rajesh Roshan. Your first journey as a refugee, Waheed, was when you were five and when you fled with your family to Pakistan, a hugely dangerous journey on horseback.
And the journey had to be taken at night time because anybody that was seen during the day, they would be attacked by helicopter gunships as well as the jets. And I had a white horse I remember very well, which I very keen on from the start. As soon as I saw him, I told my dad I really want to get on this horse.
What was the horse called?
Spin, which means white. Well, I called him Spin. I'm not sure if that was his name, but we called him Spin.
And you were literally going on mountain tracks in the dark, which were very narrow, with ravines falling down to the side, weren't you?
Extremely dangerous journey. Afghanistan is a very beautiful country. The mountains are very tall, and those narrow paths were actually where many people lost their lives. Many families disappeared altogether. So it was during that journey that we actually come under the attack three times, sadly. On one occasion was early morning when we travelled the whole night. Everybody was tired and it was becoming lighter, which meant that it was danger for us to travel. We were halfway walking to the village when my father heard something and he immediately grabbed me in his arm and he ran towards the village. I had no idea what it was, but later on he told me that it was actually a spy plane. A spy plane meant that they would call for cover to come in, and that cover is the helicopter gunships and the jets. So when my father took me in his arms, he ran towards the village, knocking on one house, on another, and there was one house that was empty. And in that house, he was looking for something. I didn't know what it was, but I saw that he looked at on the ground, and there was an oven. There was an oven where people in villages bake breads. So he took me with him in that oven, covered me, and before the jets arrived, and he asked me that, can you promise me that if anything happened to me, that you would take your family back to Kabul and you would look after them for life? So that was the initial promise that relates to the song as well and reminds me of that time.
But that bread oven did save you, didn't it? Because there was a lot of fire coming in, a lot of the house was destroyed, and it was an inspired choice to put you in there.
Fortunately, we were safe. The jets arrived, the bombardment started, the bullets. I can still remember them hitting the wall and the dust coming from every direction. After 8 to 10 minutes, we got out. He was searching for to see if there was blood on me or everything was okay. Miraculously, we survived. But many people lost their lives in that journey trying to flee for safety, which we have seen now in Ukraine as well when people try to flee and they're shelled and they lose their lives on the street.
Given that experience, I'm not entirely surprised that your next song should be very close to your heart, especially as a child. Tell us what it is.
Well, this is a song, Home Sweet Home, and I used to listen to that song for many, many years now, by Catherine Jenkins. So for me, what is home? It's still a question that I'm searching an answer for.
Catherine Jenkins singing Patrick Hamilton's arrangement of Home Sweet Home by H.R. Bishop. The orchestra was conducted by Nicholas Dodd. Now, when you arrived at the refugee camp in Pakistan, Wahid, conditions were pretty grim, weren't they? I think you can probably still remember the sort of physical pain caused by hunger.
Initially, we were happy that we were safe. But soon we realized that the conditions were very harsh. And now, thinking about it or reflecting on it, it was unlivable. As a family of eight, we were given a tent and we had to stay in that. Later on, it was upgraded to one muddy room. And there we had to live in temperatures up, rising up to 45 degrees with one fan, with little ration that was given to us by the UN Refugee Agency. And even the water, the clean water, wasn't there. It was brought by tanks. So we had to fill our buckets, keep that for us, and not to use too much of it. So that was the sort of conditions. And within days, most of us got malaria.
And not only malaria, because you got TB and you're getting weaker, coughing blood. Still a child. Did you realise how sick you were?
Within 3 months, when I started coughing, my parents initially thought it was just a cold. But it didn't turn out to be like that. I became so weak that I couldn't even walk a few metres. I became a walking skeleton and I was bringing up blood. That's when they took me to a local doctor to see what was wrong. And there was a big queue of patients. And I saw that after waiting 2 hours or so, there was this man sitting there seeing a patient after patient, but he still had a smile on him. And that's when I became curious about medicine. And he examined me. He told my dad that I had to be taken to a specialist in Peshawar City in the Khyber Bazar, which was the hustle and bustle, and that's where they took me after a couple of days to that specialist.
Do you still suffer from any of the symptoms of that, or were you completely recovered from TB?
Thanks to the specialist, I completely recovered. I had to go back and forth see him for another 18 months. But it was actually during those visits that I became even more inspired about curious first and then more inspired to become like him. I was feeling better, I was getting stronger. And every time when I used to go back, I would prepare some questions asking him, what is this? What is that? How does this medicine work? And so on. Obviously, the questions were wrong, but he was so nice to me. On the last visit, he had bought me a stethoscope and a black and white textbook. And he said, I think you will be a doctor one day.
How wonderful. And indeed, yes. You now spend a lot of your life presumably looking at X-ray films, yeah. CT scans, in much the same way that he was then. Of course, under the Taliban, music was not allowed at all, was it? So, I mean, it's pretty amazing to then discover, when you came to this country, this rich new world, I mean, your desire to be a doctor, but suddenly discovering all kinds of things. But the music you might have known, I suppose, was local music, Afghan music, and Hindi music.
Yeah, so those are the two types of music that we are accustomed to, we were listening to back in Afghanistan. During civil war, when the various Mujahideen groups were fighting each other, and again, because of that street-by-street fight, our family, like so many other families, had to flee from one part of the city to another, from one part of the country to the other. We still had one thing to look forward to, and that was a Bollywood movie. That whenever there was electricity on a Friday night, there would be Bollywood movie, and that would be screened on TV. And there was the art cinema available as well. My father would take me with him on a bicycle and we would spend 2 or 3 hours watching a Bollywood movie. That time, inside that cinema, even if it was just rubbles everywhere else around us, that would take me to another imaginary world. Playing those songs later on in my head, listening to them, that would just give me some comfort. मैं रोया परदेस में देश में भीगा माँ का प्यार हो मैं रोया परदेस में देश में भीगा माँ का प्यार ने दुख से बा
चिट्ठी भी मिलता
Pankaj Uthas singing A Letter Has Come from the 1986 film Naam. I pictured you all sitting together, probably on the floor, to watch that film. Does it bring back extraordinary memories?
Absolutely. That's how we used to sit, on the floor. For those 2-3 hours when we used to watch that movie, our entire world would be different. I used to go out on a bicycle or run, use some exercise. And then I would imagine that one day what life would be like for me. So I created an imaginary world. And it used to happen to me also when we were underground in cellars. My father was listening to radio to find out what was going on. And when he would finish, I would take a small radio and tune into BBC World Service. And that's how I started learning English. And I would listen to people talking about dinners, talking even about washing their dogs. And I'd be thinking, oh my God, where do they get this water from? Or they would talk about going to school or and all that. And so that's how I would imagine what another world would be like that I would wanted to live in. I wanted to realize my dream of becoming a doctor. I couldn't touch it, but I was starting imagining it. And it wouldn't be till much later on that when I came to the UK that it became reality.
One of the things I was wondering was, despite the war and all the hardships you endured, how you managed to keep some sense of real enjoyment and fun.
The sense of real enjoyment and fun was something that all of us had in common, and that was surrounding some of the funny movies that we would see, either Bollywood or Charlie Chaplin. Although we didn't understand the language, but he would make us laugh. And those moments were moments of relief for us, despite what was going on outside. And then it became so popular amongst various Afghans that the video cassettes would be passed on from one family member to the other. And we would just play them at a time when we were desperate for a bit of laughter.
City Lights was a silent film following Chaplin's Tramp as he falls in love with a blind girl. Although Charlie was a musician, he couldn't actually write music down, so he says that he la-la-la'd it to Arthur Johnson, who wrote it down from that.
Thank you.
Carl Davis conducted the City Lights Orchestra in the overture from Charlie Chaplin's score to City Lights, his 1931 film. The music was orchestrated by Arthur Johnston and Alfred Newman. You returned to Afghanistan from Pakistan, but very soon civil war broke out, and you described bouncing from one bolt hole to another in the city. But when you were 11, you suffered a very deep depression. What do you think it was that made it hit you just then?
It hit me because the promises that were given to me by my parents, I just could not understand that why they would not come to reality. They would tell me that 2 months later or a week later or a year later, everything would be okay, that we would go back to school, we would start living in a peaceful place. When I kept asking questions, they didn't have answers. They ran out of answers. And when I started searching for those answers, I went really into a dark place where I was losing touch with that reality, which was conflict. And that's when I started losing my appetite. I would wake up early in the morning. I couldn't sleep well. So these are signs of depression. I went to a local doctor in a village in Loga. We were there because of the ongoing fighting between the various Mujahideen groups, the civil war that was going. So he gave me some tablets. When I took those tablets, unfortunately, they made me quite sleepy. And I'm not against tablets. We give tablets to people with depression, anxiety, and they work. But for me, at that time, it wasn't the right thing because I had to be alert. I was the second in command of the family. If anything had happened to my father, I still remembered what he told me in the oven to look after the family. So I was, in a way, I had lost my childhood. I was a young boy, but with an adult mind.
With the Taliban in control of Afghanistan, music was banned. But you had a secret stash of cassettes, didn't you?
So when the Taliban took over, I came back from Kabul and I stayed with my family. My father was driving a taxi because the economy crumbled to the extent that people couldn't even afford just rice or flour. And my father would drive the taxi for 6 months just to be able to afford a sack of rice. He would come home very tired, and from time to time I would take that taxi. It was in 99 when I was 15, just to help him. The streets were empty. It was the Taliban who were our customers. I had a stash of cassettes with me that I would listen to Bollywood songs, to Afghan music. But I also had a few other songs that were more religious. And I kept that. As soon as the Taliban would come in, I would play that for them.
Yes, you didn't want to put the wrong one on.
Oh, no, I didn't want to do that.
So you kept them, the ones that you shouldn't play to the Taliban, you kept under the seat of the car?
I did.
I'd love you to choose a track now from one of those precious cassettes.
Well, it is by Ahmad Wali. It's called Aftab, and that is Sun. This is actually released lately, but it just reminds me of the songs that I used to play at that time in Afghanistan. The songs by Afghan singers, they have got deeper meaning to them. And usually the themes are around when would the sun shine? When would the spring be around the corner? When would the flowers blossom? And when would happiness come?
Ay aftab, ay aftab, ay aftab. Yeah.
Amhad Wali with Aftab. And all the details of the music of my guest today, Dr. Wahid Aryan, are on the Private Passions webpage. If you search on Sounds, you can find hundreds of past programmes to download. Wahid, let's go to a decisive time in your life, the spring of 1999, when you were 15 and your father paid some people traffickers to get you out of Afghanistan. And you had to say goodbye to your family and begin that long, long journey to Britain. What finally made you leave, do you think?
There were a combination of factors. One, I was coming to an age 15, that I might have had to follow my father's fate of being pushed to serve the military. At that time, the Taliban was serving, so I could have been asked at any moment to fight alongside them, to kill people, which I didn't want to. I wanted to heal people. I was inspired to become a doctor. I just could not find a way to do it. The schools were destroyed in Afghanistan. So I tried to convince my parents for more than a year to let me go. And the final factor that played on their mind to let me go. But when the rocket flattened the house next door, and with that the entire family, my parents decided, okay, the only way for you to be safe is just to go away. So they sold everything. They put that money into the hands of an agent because the official routes didn't exist, and they still don't exist in conflict zones. And that's how that agent got me a passport, got me on a plane.
A forged passport, yes. You got a flight to London with the idea, quite understandably, that when you arrived, you'd be welcomed with open arms as a refugee. The reality was somewhat different, wasn't it?
It was. When I landed, I was arrested, mainly because of the passport that I had. The agent said that this is a refugee visa, which wasn't correct. It was a forged passport, but we couldn't question anybody. You know, when you're fleeing from conflict, you have two choices. One, to stay there, to be killed, or to take whatever route is available. And that's the passport he gave us, and it took me to London. And when arrested, I was sent to Feltham, Young Offenders Institute, for 2 weeks. And then I found a very kind barrister who was connected to me by a family friend who used to live in Portobello Road. And I knew him from Afghanistan during my time in Pakistan, Peshawar. So he assigned that barrister to me, and he came in and he argued correctly and legally that refugees, whatever routes they take, they shouldn't be punished. even if that route seems to be illegal, because that's the only one available to them.
When you were released from prison and granted refugee status, you managed to get all sorts of jobs as a cleaner, working in a gift shop, working on a fruit and vegetable stall. You mentioned the Portobello. But that last job had in particular challenges for you, didn't it?
And I got that job one morning that I went and I said, oh, do you need somebody to work? I said, like, yeah, come on, mate. You can just work with us. And they gave me a bill and they said...
A money belt they gave you.
A money belt where the money was. And I was listening to them saying stuff to customers and I would start to repeat what they were saying.
Like a parrot.
Like a parrot. And I think most of it was wrong, but I would just point with my finger, you know, £3 for a pound, £3 for a pound. I wouldn't know what the names were because I usually forget. But they would come out so wrong. Even now, reflecting on it, one was courgette. Look at the fresh courgette.
Courgette.
Yes. And they would look at me like, are you okay, mate? And so I'm like, well, I'm doing my job.
It's almost unbelievable that you were able to move from working on market stalls to training as a doctor at Cambridge. But that is what happened. And somehow you managed to study at night to get Science A levels. But that must have taken an incredible effort.
It did take a lot of effort. So when I landed in the UK, I was 15, had no family, with hardly any formal education and $100 in my pocket. And I didn't know where to start. That was the big question for me. So I asked my local refugee friends what to do, the people who I lived with. So they gathered together one evening. They got a meeting deciding my future. And at the end of it, they said, Wahid, listen, we know your background. You're a refugee. You've hardly been to school. You are not white. So there are so many factors against you. So they told me, continue working in a chicken shop. Then you will become a taxi driver like us. And then at some point, you might own a chicken shop. So in a way, their path for me was to become a chicken wing specialist. I admire hard work, but I wanted to become a medical specialist. So I went on my own trying to figure out how to do this. So I went to a library in Notting Hill and I tried to look for ways how to do this. And I then went to one of the medical school, Imperial College in London, and I asked the admissions officer. I turned up and I said, I want to become a doctor. And this lady very nicely asked me, excuse me? And I said, I want to become a doctor. How do I do this? And it's like, well, which school do you go to? I said, well, I'm not going to school. And I started first learning English on my own. I went to Maryville College. I sat for the pre-A-level test. And I thought, if I fail this, I will do GCSE. If I pass that, then I will go straight for the AS. I borderline passed that exam. And they allowed me to do the AS. And that was the beginning of my journey of doing AS. And I soon realized that actually, from the mock exams, when I got a D, that I needed an A. So I had to work extremely hard. And that meant for me that I used every single waking hour working. Even when there were no customers, I had my book there. And at night, I was reading past papers. And I completely focused on it. In such a tunnel vision that I, apart from supporting family members, supporting my brother, I was working on A-levels.
I think there'll be some parents listening to this programme who are saying, I wish young so-and-so would listen to some of this and take a bit of advice.
But I think everybody has in them the potential to do something. As long as they want it, as long as it sits with their dream, they should pursue it.
Mm. Piano music now, and I think this is thanks to an older lady who you visited in Cambridge as a student, and actually she ended up playing the piano for you.
So at Cambridge University, I became increasingly isolated. So there was a charity for the elderly where students can go and speak and spend some time with them. And I realised that that could be something that I could help with. And when I signed up for that, I was assigned to this lovely lady near our college. And I visited her in a flat. And as soon as I would enter and I would see this big smile, she would welcome me home. And for me, it was somewhere that I could call home, which didn't exist for me. For me, it was a college room. I would go out. I would be somebody extremely isolated, living in my own world, locking away my traumas. But in that house, in that flat, I could relax. Instead of me doing things for her, she would make me a cup of tea. And then she one day proposed that, oh, do you like listening to music? I said, I'd love to. And there was a piano. She sat on the piano. Although she said, oh, I've got arthritis, and I knew she was suffering. And as soon as she started playing the piano, it was magical.
I was thinking as we were listening to that wonderful Schubert impromptu in A-flat major, Deutsch 899, played by Imogen Cooper, and very beautifully, I was thinking that music actually has, doesn't it, within it, a kind of joyous celebration of life and a nostalgia, and sort of the, you know, it's the bittersweet quality of life.
Well, that's an extremely good summary of it, bittersweet.
How did you feel with the other Cambridge students, Wahid? I mean, I think you felt that you were sort of wearing a mask a lot of the time.
Yes, wearing a mask was in a way that for me to protect my emotions, to protect all the memories that were there and subconsciously knowing that they would make me uncomfortable. So I couldn't find that deeper connection. And the only person I found some sort of deeper connection with was this kitchen porter, actually, who was at Trinity Hall College. And I would talk about family with him because we had a connection. He was helping his family and I was helping my family. But having said that, the college was extremely kind to me. And on the paper, I would articulate what my problems were. The tutors knew that I was also struggling academically as a result of that to start with. They supported me enormously and they gave me money as well. And they said that, Wahid, if you're working to support your brother and yourself, you don't have to. We'll give you some money. And I still have got a very close relationship with my tutors.
It sounds very difficult, even though you'd fulfilled your childhood ambition of becoming a doctor, and then you decided that you needed to find some way of helping other doctors in places like Afghanistan, and you founded a telemedicine charity. Tell me how that works.
So 2010, when I became a doctor, that was realization of one of my primary dreams. And to be able to serve in the NHS was also for me to give back to the country that gave me so much, to the people who kindly embraced me as their own. But then I also turned my attention to Afghanistan because I knew there was so much trauma, so much suffering in Afghanistan. And despite being there, a new government supported by the West. So I kept going back and forth to Afghanistan to see my family members. But after staying a couple of nights with my mum and dad, I would immediately go to a local hospital, introduce myself. And I soon realized that they needed a lot of medical expertise. They didn't have the chance to go abroad to attend conferences to update their knowledge. And that was the gap that later on I wanted to fill in by connecting specialists from the NHS to start with initially. And then later on, we've got volunteers from across the world, like from America, from Canada and Australia, that they give advice to medics in Afghanistan on smartphones. It could be a bomb blast. It could be a chronic illness. It could be a child falling into the well, which happens into the villages. And they sustain so many various injuries, from head injury to broken bones to punctured lungs. So these are complex traumas, and they... doctor would video call with another doctor over here in real time, not with a delay.
Wahid, you didn't really have any normal childhood yourself. Now you're married and have two children. I wonder whether you feel you're able to live, in a way, your own childhood through them.
I do. It's absolutely magical to have two kids. Zane, he has just turned 6 today. And I have a daughter called Alana, who is 2. And growing up, I'm actually reliving my own childhood. I never got the chance to play too much or hardly any time to play. But even I remember that in a refugee camp, I was desperate to have a remote controlled car. I never got one. And my son, he had dozens of them now. So I take the remote control from him from time to time. I said, like, mate, let me play on it.
I wonder what has happened to your family back in Afghanistan and whether you are able to still keep close contact with them.
My mother sadly passed away in 2020. And my father is in Kabul still. Two of my siblings, two brothers, they're displaced now in America. They've become refugees. And my sister has become a refugee in Sweden. So the recent events in Afghanistan have severely impacted millions of Afghans. More than 24 million are living in poverty. And sadly, my family is also impacted. I try my best to send them some money and comfort them in any way I can. But they are all trapped. My sisters are all trapped there. But they're looking after each other, looking after my father. And sadly, the situation is extremely uncertain, like for so many Afghans.
It's been very moving talking to Wahid about this extraordinary story. We're going to finish with a song which became a symbol of hope during the early months of the pandemic. It's the Italian tenor Andrea Bocelli singing in the empty cathedral of Milan on Easter Day 2020, a recording which went viral on social media. What does it say to you, and why have you chosen it to finish?
So this piece of music, this song, resonated with me. It was all about hope. It was all about coming together. It's about supporting each other. And I've been fighting the pandemic as an A&E doctor since the beginning of the pandemic, and I still work in A&E every weekend. I run the charity during the week. Throughout my life, I was hanging on to hope. I was hanging on to the fact not to give up, that one day things will be okay. And that's how that listening to that song reminded me, for me personally, not to give up on hope.
Wahid, Ariane. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. Now I'm found, was blind, but now I see. T'was grace that taught my heart to fear, and grace my fears relieved. How precious did that grace
Andrea Bocelli performing Amazing Grace in an arrangement by William Ross, a performance recorded live in the Milan Duomo Cathedral on Easter Sunday 2020 during the height of the coronavirus lockdown. That was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions Today, Wahid Ariane. The episode was produced by Elizabeth Burke and it's a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news read by me, Vigialis. Finland has formally announced that the country will apply for NATO membership in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The Prime Minister, Sanna Marin, described the move as historic and said he hoped Parliament would confirm the decision in the coming days. Finland has an 800-mile border with Russia and has been non-aligned for more than 70 years. Moscow has insisted that its neighbour is making a mistake. Sweden also looks poised to join the alliance. British military intelligence says Russia has lost a third of the ground combat forces it sent to Ukraine at the start of its invasion. The defence assessment also says it's lost momentum and fallen significantly behind schedule. The Kremlin insists the campaign is making steady progress. The business secretary, Kwasi Kwarteng, has denied there will be a trade war with the European Union over the Northern Ireland Protocol. But he's told the BBC the UK won't be deterred from taking action to maintain political stability. There are reports that the government is poised to take unilateral action to strip away parts of the deal which governs trade between Britain and Northern Ireland after Brexit. Ireland's Foreign Minister Simon Coveney has said there would be a consequence if the UK abandoned its international treaty obligations. An 18-year-old man has appeared in court charged with murdering 10 people at a supermarket in Buffalo in New York State. 13 people were shot in total. Most of them were black, and authorities say it was racially motivated. Police say Peyton Gendron drove more than 300 kilometres to carry out the attack, which he live-streamed. Earlier, he posted a white supremacist manifesto online. People in Lebanon are voting in the first parliamentary election since an economic collapse that's fuelled widespread anger. The devastating explosion in Beirut in 2020 deepened the sense among many Lebanese that the political system needed to be changed. Ukraine's President Zelensky has said he hopes his country can host the Eurovision Song Contest next year after their triumph at the competition in Italy last night. In a social media post, he said, "Our courage impresses the world. Our music conquers Europe." The Ukrainian entry, the Kalush Orchestra, went to the top of the leaderboard after winning the popular vote. The UK's entry, Sam Ryder, finished second. The weather now, and it'll be cloudy across most parts of the UK this afternoon, with sunny spells in the south and in the far north. Highs reaching 22 Celsius in Cardiff, 21 in London and 15 in Belfast.
If you're calling about your mobile phone,
please scan an item.
I have read the terms and conditions.
Charting the rise of the automated society.
Please take the next exit on the left.
To create a piece of art.
I've been set the challenge of turning some of these messages that we're surrounded by.
Select another option.
Bombarded by or bothered by on a daily basis.
Door closing.
Into some kind of music.